to gives us our best view, best wide angle view of what's going on. How about a view from Mars? That's right, a view from Mars. Visit Jim Mars at jimmars.com for that view from Mars. That's two R's, M-A-R-R-S, jimmars.com. He's our guest right now. What a fabulous, what a fabulous guest. A very prolific author, New York Times bestseller. We're going to be talking this segment about our occulted history, putting some, connecting some dots, actually. Before we get to Jim, I might just want to mention that rocket stoves are the way to go. I have to relate a story just very quickly. I use Minuteman rocket stoves, tried them out, love them. Minuteman rocket stove. If you go to MinutemanStove.com, that's MinutemanStove.com, you can see what I'm talking about. These are the reinforced ammo cans, if you will, that provide a heat source for any type of an emergency, and they are fantastic. I actually put, on my way to the studio, I put the rocket stove on top. You know, folks, you know what I did? I put it on top of my my vehicle, on the hood. And as I was driving out of the driveway, on my way to the studio, I hear this awful racket. And I didn't know what happened. I thought maybe somebody threw a rock or something at my car, and the stove tumbled off of the roof of my car onto the back and onto the ground. Now, you ordinarily, you would think a product like that wouldn't survive that fall. Let me tell you, it survived it just fine. So, folks, in these uncertain times, it just makes sense to have a sustainable backup method for accomplishing one of life's most important tasks, that's preparing food. This is the way to go. There is nothing better than a Minuteman rocket stove from MinutemanStove.com. Nothing better at all, and they hold up when you put them on the hood of your car and drive off. I would dare say you, other stoves would not. We all need a way to cook and a method to process water. Of course, a disruption of power. I mean, think about it. Think about the many things that could happen to you, or happen to the fuel distribution, the power supply. Well, have something in your ready to go bag or your pantry. Minuteman rocket stove can provide your family or group the perfect solution, and that is, it's small, lightweight, wood burning, and every bit as powerful as a kitchen stove with decent wood. It's smokeless, fully self-contained for clean storage and transport. Because it's so efficient, it cuts down on your wood gathering and processing chores to a tenth. And I mean a tenth of what would be required if cooking the old-fashioned way, like over an open fire. So don't rely on gas or fuel stoves. You can, but don't. Because eventually, the supply is going to run dry. Burning wood inefficiently requires a lot of manual labor. This stove, only at MinutemanStove.com, at least that's where I would go, only there at MinutemanStove.com, is the way to go. It solves all of your problems. It's easy to feed and easy to use. Prepare your family. Prepare for yourself. Order a Minuteman rocket stove today. It's going to make bad times much better. Lane Miller, he's the owner. Go to Minuteman, go to the website, MinutemanStove.com, and take a look at his crew. This is all American-made, made in the U.S. American jobs, American labor, American, it's an American product. The stoves come with a 2-year warranty even when you drive off with them on your hood, and they bounce around and they last. So, MinutemanStove.com. Great, just a fantastic product. MinutemanStove.com. Our guest again, Jim Mars. So great. He's such a gracious man and so intelligent. Jim, thanks for bearing with me as I fly solo. Joe will be back on Monday. Of course, he's nursing a wounded ankle. And, but thanks for granting us being so gracious with your time. Let's get right into it.
You mean thanks for filling up the airways? Since,
no.
Unfortunately, Joe's not there to help you fill in.
Oh, that's all right. That's all right. Yeah, it's so great. Now, let's talk about wherever you want to go. And I know our occulted history, your book, is kind of really causing a lot of not controversy, but a lot of people to talk, because you make a lot of connections. You're talking about UFOs. Where do you want to start with this?
It's hard to even know where to go, but quickly on UFOs. again, when I started, I've been at it a long time, folks. And when I started off, and any talk came up about UFOs, it was, there's no such thing. The government's position was they don't exist, okay? Actually, all it was just delusions, misinterpretation of aircraft, and possibly some kind of mass psychosis, which may sound strange today, but seriously, in the 50s and 60s, this is what we were being told. And Doug, I thought, even as a young reporter, I thought, wow, what a story. A heretofore undiagnosed contagious mass psychosis. You know, that's got to be a story. Well, you don't hear about that anymore, and the reason is because with the advent of the camcorder and, of course, today's ubiquitous cell phones with all, you know, that can take videos and photographs. If you go Google up UFOs, you could probably spend the rest of your life looking at the photographs we have now of UFOs, and it's not always just a light in the sky. There are craft, there are structures there. Okay, so the argument about do they exist, you don't hear that anymore. It's gone. Yes, they're here. The question becomes, who are they, what do they want? All right. Now, the key thing to remember is this is not a recent phenomena. This goes all the way back through our earliest history. The Hindu Vedas, which are probably amongst the oldest writings in the world, talk about the flying Vyamas, okay, and how that they had even weapons that could destroy an entire city. You go back to the Sumerian civilization, Sumer, it's S-U-M-E-R, and quickly let me differentiate that between, in the Bible we read about the Good Samaritan and people from Samaria. That was an area of Palestine, of that area over there. I'm talking about Sumer, S-U-M-E-R. This was the area in what is today Iraq. It was between the Tigris-Euphrates River. And those people wrote down their history and their thoughts and all of their information in cuneiform tablets. They would take clay and they used a stylus to write down everything they wanted to write down, and then they would bake that clay and turn it to stone. And there's thousands, in fact, half a million of these writings, tablets, still in existence, but they're hidden away in various museums all around the world. And it was not until the mid-1800s that anybody got around to trying to translate them. So when they began to translate them, they found out about the Anunnaki. Well, the Anunnaki translates basically as those who came from the heavens and landed on the earth. Okay, well, in the mid-1800s, the most advanced scientists had no concept of space flight or atoms or genetics, DNA. They just, you know, that they didn't know anything about that. So when they would read about these people who came and flew through the air, who landed, who taught law and mathematics, architecture, they just wrote it all off as, well, that's their mythology. That's their gods. And you, in fact, you can go to the Encyclopedia Britannica today. If you look under Sumerian mythology, you'll find the whole story. The only thing that's changed in recent years, starting with the prolific number of books by Zachariah Sitchin, who was a translator of the Sumerian language, but he's not alone. There are many others now. And what has happened is that our perception, the translations are the same. It's our perception of them and interpretation. More and more people are now believing that what they were talking about, and we wrote off as their mythology, is actually history, what they actually knew. And in fact, if you start comparing the mythologies, you find that they're all have a line of similarity. For example, in the Sumerian, they talked about their god who was in charge of the earth, and that was Enlil. Well, we find the Egyptians say, well, there was a Lord over the earth that was set. The Greeks say, no, the Lord over the earth was Zeus. And the Romans, of course, said, no, it's Jupiter. Okay, the names change because of the language change. But the characteristics and the attributes of these characters remain the same. Now, am I trying to say that these were all gods? No. They were beings of advanced knowledge. In fact, when I wrote my book, Alien Agenda, I interviewed a woman who was a very devout Christian, and she had had one of these so-called abduction experiences, and they had taken her aboard a ship. They had taken her to some other world, shown her things, and the whole time she's going, but what about God? Don't you believe in God? And she said, one of them finally turned to her and said, look, our God is your God. You know, and of course, if you stop and think about it, the God of the universe is the God of the universe. And I think it's kind of arrogant for us to think that God made all of these billions of galaxies that contain billions of suns, that contain billions of worlds revolving around those suns, just so we'd have something to look at in the night sky. You know, if there is a God of the universe, which I believe there is, and I know you do too, Doug, most of your audience, I think, believes that, then he's the God of the universe, right?
Sure.
Okay, so it's important to understand that these, what they called gods, or we'll simply call them the Anunnaki, because that's what they called them. In fact, in the writings of the ancient Sumerians, they never referred to them as gods. They just said the Anunnaki. The Anunnaki did this. They came here. They went there. They did this. You know, it's only the translators in the 1800s who had no concept of space flight or of other worlds and all like that, who said, well, they must be talking about their primitive gods. And so it's really an amazing and expanding understanding of the world and the universe. So, according also to these tablets, these Anunnaki decided that they, hundreds of thousands of years ago, came here, and they decided they wanted to see if they could create some workers, somebody to do all the grunt work for them, okay? And so, interestingly enough, their science officer, Inky, says, well, you know, I'm working with some earth primitives in down in what we now know is Africa. He says, I think I can tweak their DNA a little bit and maybe upgrade them a little bit, and we can make a worker race to do the work for us. Now, interestingly enough, in the Council of the Anunnaki, they had the same moral debates that we have today about cloning and about genetic manipulation. And they were saying that, hey, you know, we can't play God. There is a God of the universe, and he's the creative force, and that's not up to us. So it's important to understand that what Inky ordered or argued was that, well, look, we're not creating anything. We're just improving the breed. All right, just exactly as we do with sheep, horses, cows, dog, cats. Okay, we haven't created any of those, but we improved the breed. We use crossbreeding and for centuries to produce, you know, horses that can run a little faster, cats that have not so long hair, and all like that. So it's important to understand when you hear somebody talking about these ancient astronauts or these ancient aliens and how that they manipulated our DNA. Nobody is suggesting that we are created by aliens. Only God can create things. But it does appear that we have been improved or manipulated. Our DNA has been manipulated by these ancient astronauts. And it goes all the way back. Let's not forget Ezekiel, who, by the way, I happen to think is a good reporter, because Ezekiel didn't say, I was eating mushrooms one day, and I had these visions, and I saw this. He starts off saying, by the river Shebar in the year so-and-so after the king released this. And he gives us very specific details. And then, of course, he sees what he calls a vision of God. And he calls it that because that's the only way he knows how to describe it. He doesn't know what it is. But it makes a great whirling sound. It makes a great noise. There's a lot of dust and smoke. There's fire. The thing lands. And if you keep reading in the book of Ezekiel, you'll find out that it picks him up, and it takes him up in the air, and it takes him to a mountaintop, and it takes him to a city. So, unlike some of the more modern translations where they say he had visions, that's not exactly what he said. He said he was sitting there, he saw this thing, and it was a vision of God. And I do want to throw this at you. I think you're going to love this one, Doug, because this is something you probably don't know about and something you can test for yourself. And it also shows that I, for one, believe the Bible is inspired by God. But I do also believe that over the years, through the Council of Nicaea and onward, that it's been edited and redacted by people, okay? So you have to look at the overall message, and you cannot pull one statement or one verse out of the Bible and build a whole philosophy on it. Let's go to the King James Bible, which is the one that I was brought up on, probably the one you were brought up on, and is pretty much the basis for all of the editions of the Bible that we have today. Now, if you'll open it up and look at the fly page, you'll see that it says the Bible according to King James. All right. Now, number one, I don't recall anybody trying to say that King James was the son of God. In fact, he wasn't even that literate, but he was smart. So he hired 45 scholars to read, transcribe, and put together what we now know as the King James Bible. So there's 45 of them, but there was a 46th because he put one person in charge, and that person happened to be Sir Francis Bacon. And if you'll do your deep study of Sir Francis Bacon, you'll find that there are many people of very great intelligence and education, such as Mark Twain, such as Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote the Sherlock Holmes material, and many others who claim that it was Sir Francis Bacon who actually was behind the writing of the Shakespeare material.
Yeah,
now, there's been
Jim,
a controversy.
I do believe that. I didn't mean to interrupt you or talk over you.
No.
But
there's a lot of people. This has been an ongoing controversy, right?
Right.
And a lot of people know that he's been accused of writing the Shakespeare material, or at least along with his Invisible College. And that's because, and you may not know this, the whole thing is there's secrets everywhere. You know, we talked about the Kennedy assassination. We're told one thing, reality is something else. We're told that Queen Elizabeth the First was called the Virgin Queen, and yet, according to my studies, she gave birth to Sir Francis Bacon. He was the illegitimate son of Queen Elizabeth. And this is why she set up her summer palace right next to the Bacon estate. So she got the Bacon family to adopt her illegitimate son and raise him as Sir Francis Bacon. And that's why he was her favorite for the longest time. And she saw to it that he got the best education. He was thoroughly schooled in court etiquette, all of the things we see reflected in the Shakespeare material. And this is something that's bugged the scholars for years, is that Shakespeare, there was a historical Shakespeare, but he was just barely literate, and he was a commoner. And they've often wondered, how could he have known all of the court etiquette and the expressions and the protocols of the day, you know, without having this royal pedigree. Well, Sir Francis Bacon did. And see, he then was put in charge of the 45 scholars who were putting together the King James Bible. Now, back then, everything was hidden. They had to be very surreptitious in what they were saying, because if they produced a play, say, like Macbeth, and at that time, probably the general consensus was that King Duncan had simply died in his sleep. Well, but they wrote Macbeth, and we now know that Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, they poisoned him, okay? So that they were telling truth to the public at that time through the most public medium they had, which was the theater, all right? But they couldn't do it in their name, so they put William Shakespeare's name on it, and I think it was kind of an open secret. It was one of these secrets like John F. Kennedy messing around with Marilyn Monroe. People in the know knew that was going on, but it was just not talked about, and it was not publicized, and it was the same type situation. I think everyone, including Queen Elizabeth, probably knew that her son, Francis Bacon, was actually writing these plays, but because of politics, they didn't want to put his head in danger, so they shoved it off on William Shakespeare, and that's why it was 100 years or more before anybody got around to writing about Shakespeare. But to make a long story short, they also had their secret ciphers and their secret codes. Sir Francis Bacon, well, we know that John Dee went by the secret code of 007. He was England's original 007, long before James Bond. And we know that Sir Francis Bacon, his code was 46. And I think he took that because he was the 46th person to work on the King James Bible. Now, if you want to see the hint that he left behind to show us this was probably true, go to the King James Bible and go to Psalms 46. If you'll count from the first, you'll find, and you'll count 46 words, you get to the word shake. If you'll go 46 words from the end of Psalms 46, you'll get to the word spear, Shakespeare. This was Francis Bacon's little code letting us know who was in charge, not only of writing the King James Bible, but also who was behind the writings of Shakespeare. Is that wild or what?
Very interesting. Now, does that translate out? Is that accurate in terms of the translation? I mean, the Psalms. What am I trying to say here? It works out to the original language.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, you have to make sure you get the King James version of the Bible, because in other later versions, you know, they've changed this, they've changed that. It may shift the words pretty much. But in the King James Bible, the first line reads, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. The very last line says, the Lord of hosts is with us, the Lord of Jacob is our refuge. And if you count 46 words in, you get shake. 46 words from the back, you get spear.
Very interesting. No, that's something I didn't know. Yeah, I did not know that. And I know, if folks, look, you know, we know that God's word is incorruptible, but man certainly can corrupt anything he puts his hands on. So
that,
you know, so it's one of those things.
Well, to me, it's amazing that over all the centuries, the fact that the Bible was put together early on as simply oral tradition. In other words, they'd talk about it over the campfires. And it was only within about 300 years of the life of Jesus that they finally started writing it down. And I think I could be wrong on this. I don't claim to be a huge scholar. I'm just a reporter. But I think it was first put down in Aramaic, and then it was put down in Greek, and then it got translated into Roman, and then, you know, and then, of course, once Constantine, the Roman emperor, made Christianity the official religion of Rome, And from that point, then we begin getting then you have the councils of Troy, the councils of Nicaea, and all of these councils where they all would say, well, we like this verse, we don't like that verse, and we like this book, but we don't like that book. And they, you know, and you got all this editing like that, all the way up till today, where now you have all these branches. You got the Standard Bible, you got the Living Bible, you know, I don't know, the Working Man's Bible. And what I'm getting at, Doug, is it's amazing to me, and I think a tribute to the truth of God, that we have so much truth still existing in the Bible today.
Jim, you know, that very redemptive statement, I must say, but that is, you're 100% correct on that. Folks, our guest is Jim Mars, jimmars.com, that's M-A-R-R-S, author of Our Occulted History, Ruled by Secrecy, and just a number of books. I think he's up to 10, perhaps. It's just a very prolific author, best-selling, New York Times best-selling author, and of course, he's our guest tonight, talking about a variety of issues, including Our Occulted History, available on Amazon.com. Very interesting read. Boy, I gotta ask him, too. Something was found in Iraq, and we'll get to this. I don't know whenever Jim wants to, but I'm interested about what was found in Iraq here in 2003-ish or thereabouts.
Okay.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, whenever it's time for that. Folks, Jim Mars, jimmars.com. Stay right there with us. More to come. Mars. I usually say a view from cruising altitude, but when you get a view from Mars, you get a really huge glimpse of what's going on. You know, you might be asking, well, what does this have to do with, oh, I don't know, the current presidential elections, the current political landscape? What does this have to do with anything? Well, you know, past is prologue, isn't it? A lot of history was written and rewritten. And we talk about the New World Order, don't we? Well, come to find out, New World Order is maybe the Old World Order 2.0. I guess that's one way of putting it. Portions of tonight's broadcast brought to you not just by Minuteman Stove, but also by AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com. That's AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com. Long-term storable food, visit AmericanSurvivalWholesale.com. We're talking with Jim Mars. He's our guest. I'm flying solo. Joe is getting his ankle checked out. Don't know. Maybe it's broken. Maybe not. But our prayers are with him. He'll be back on Monday, I'm sure. Jim Mars has been... We've been talking about a lot of different things. And you know, it's interesting, too, as I said earlier, I laid his books out across my conference table, and he has really woven a tapestry of history. The investigative reporter in him really has set a lot of, documented a lot of our history, and it's amazing. What we think is history? Revised. Revised for the people in power right now. That's what it has to do with the current day. Now, Jim, thanks for holding through the break. I had mentioned the discovery in Iraq, and perhaps I was a little bit premature on that. And I didn't want to.
Well, no, but you have to, again, unfortunately, I have to give some background.
Okay.
So that you understand what happened in Iraq. Number one, we know it wasn't about weapons of mass destruction. We know it wasn't about getting their oil. It wasn't about bringing freedom and democracy. So yeah. What was the deal behind our precipitous invasion of Iraq? Well, let's go back. And back to when I mentioned about the ancient Sumerian tablets that tell us in the far distant prehistory that these Anunnaki came and landed on the earth and created this great civilization in Sumer. All right. right. One of their leading cities, by the way, was Ur, U-R, which was located right down the, at the near the Persian Gulf, where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers come together. Now, who was it in the Bible who came from Ur? It was Abraham. It was Abraham. And if you look in the Bible, it says Abraham came from Ur of Chaldea. Well, Chaldea was simply an old term for Mesopotamia, which is now Iraq, one of the few places on the world that free Americans can't just freely go to and travel to, unless you want to join the military.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, that's true.
So Abraham, who was the patriarch and the founder of the Hebrews, but also the patriarch, founders of the Semites, and that's another thing that people need to understand. If you try to say something against the policies of Israel, they say, oh, well, you're an anti-Semite. And if you want to throw them off, say, no, I like the Palestinians. And that'll throw them off. Because no. The Palestinians are Semites, and they trace their heritage back to Abraham. So Abraham was not a Jew, he was not a Hebrew, he was not a Palestinian, he was a Sumerian, a ranking Sumerian, because Ur, Uruk, Haran, many of these ancient Sumerian cities were named after his relatives. So he was a ranking Sumerian and therefore probably had the knowledge that had been passed down piecemeal and broken. You know, we didn't get the whole thing, but we got bits and pieces of the knowledge that came from these Anunnaki. And he carried that knowledge into Egypt. And then after he had arrived in Egypt, with his knowledge, probably not him personally, but with his people and his extended family, with the people he brought with him, all of a sudden we have this incredibly advanced civilization that arose in Egypt to become the dynasties of Egypt. And what's wild about that, Doug, is that the earliest ones were the best ones. The jewelry and the techniques and the ways of living were higher in the older dynasties than in the later ones. In other words, the Egyptian civilization didn't evolve, it devolved. And it came down from the advanced technology that was brought with Abraham. Now, part of this included in the Egyptian stories and mythology, pharaohs, in the Book of the Dead, on their way to, as they studied about how to make their way to the afterlife, they talked about the Shemana, or the Mafus, or which was apparently, or the conical bread. And we see this in the carvings of the Egyptians, where the pharaohs are offering these conical things. It was called the conical bread. It was called the shamana, and it was supposed to help them build up their body, their mind, their spirit on the way to the afterlife. In fact, on the Book of the Dead, at each stage along the way to the afterlife, the pharaoh was supposed to say, "What is it?" Which is, to me, is really, really interesting, because when the Hebrews left Egypt under Moses and they traveled in the wilderness, they survived because they would wake up in the mornings and there would be this white powdery substance laying around on the ground, and they would gather it up and they would put a little water with it and they would make it into a dough, and they'd make it and bake it, and then they'd eat it, and that's what they called manna. They called it the manna from heaven, okay, because they didn't know where it came from. And interestingly enough, in ancient Hebrew, manna means what is it? They didn't know what it was. And nobody in the preceding history has known exactly what it was. But now I think we have a hint, because back in the 80s, a farmer out in Arizona discovered single atom elements that are found in gold, silver, copper, cobalt, nickel, along with a lot of the more exotic metals such as platinum, palladium, rhodium. And in fact, they are found in our bodies and in our food and in our water. He had this single atom elements patented under the name Orbitally Rearranged Monatomic Elements. All right, and again, I think we see the hand of God in this, because it turns out that O-R-M-E is ancient Hebrew for the tree of life. Okay, so he found some very strange things about these orbitally rearranged monatomic elements, which are now being studied scientifically, and there's been a number of scientific papers dealing with it. Titles are microclusters, super deformation of nuclei, new radioactivities, super deformation, collective and single particle structure. These are all scientific, new superconductors. These are all being now studied. And here's what's wild. They found that when you put this white powder, that gold can actually, through a smelting process, a heating treatment, can be reduced to this white powder. And oddly enough, you can take the white powder and through a reverse process, you can turn it back into a piece of material gold. But it even gets better, Doug. They found when they put the white powder of gold in a scale in the weighing pan, the pan weighs 44% less than it did before you put the powder in it. Somehow this powder has anti-gravitic properties. Now this is really interesting, because now this leads us to the Ark of the Covenant, which was acacia wood plated with pure gold. And we know the mercy lid was 3.5 inches thick and made of pure gold, and was estimated to weigh 2,714 pounds. And yet we see these illustrations where they have four or five guys supposedly carrying the ark along. Well, wait a minute, three or four people can't really carry more than a ton, 2,700 pounds. So now we understand that, and there are accounts that within the Ark of the Covenant was this white powder. Well, now we see that if it was the monatomic powder of gold, then they weren't carrying the ark. It was kind of floating. They were just guiding it along. And I think this gives us a whole new understanding of basic, this ancient technology that we had. And we see other evidence of this, by the way, in the story when Moses goes up on the mountain to get the Ten Commandments. And by the way, he also got the Tables of Testimony, which nobody much talks about, but I would really like to hear what was all in that. Another thing that we tend to forget is that when he came down with the Ten Commandments, he found the children of Israel knowing that something magical was happening with the gold, but they didn't know the secrets. They didn't know what it was. But they had taken all their gold and they had melted it down and made it into a golden calf. And they were worshiping it. Well, this made Moses so mad that he threw the Ten Commandments down and broke them. And he had to go back up on the mountain and say, "Lord, I'm sorry, but I kind of broke your commandments. Would you give them to me again?" And God said, "Nope, you're just going to have to remember them." And so that's something else I think we need to remember. We are getting what Moses remembered of the Ten Commandments, and I just hope his memory was good. And by the way, there is a side issue there I feel like I need to throw out. because the commandment that he remembered that says, thou shalt not kill, well, that's caused a lot of problem over the centuries, because people who join the army are fighting a war, and you know, there's a lot of people who want to be a conscientious objector, and they say it's just not right to kill. Okay, I have spoken with Hebrew scholars who say that the word, the original word that was used, has been mistranslated as kill. Okay, it said that the actual word used was thou shalt not murder. Okay,
correct.
And I think, yep, Doug, you understand the distinction.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
If you set out maliciously or out of some petty motive and you murder somebody, that is bad. If you have to kill somebody who is breaking into your home and is a direct threat to your to you or your family or your loved ones, that's not murder. That is self-defense. And in fact, as you well know, in the New Testament, when the disciples came to Jesus and said, hey, the Roman authorities are after us, you know, should we defend ourselves? What did he say? He said, have you got a sword? If you don't have a sword, go buy a sword.
That's right.
So I think Jesus shows us that self-defense and killing in a righteous cause is defensible. But Jim,
I just want to say one thing in defense of that. Not that it needs defending. Thou shalt not murder. And the translation issues. I had a couple of numerous emails right now saying, well, you know, the Bible is clear, the King James version of the Bible, and the other versions, especially like the New King James, they're very similar in translations. Folks, let me tell you something. The new Jim, pardon me for interrupting here, but I just want to make this clear. The new, just for those people who believe, for example, that the King James and the New King James version are the same or very similar, close. For example, the New King James version of the Bible omits the word Lord 66 times. The word God is omitted 51 times. The word heaven is omitted 50 times. Do you want me to go on? The word hell is omitted 22 times. The word damnation is completely taken out. The word devils is completely taken out. So those of you out there, and many Christians who think, well, wait, you know, New King James Version, okay, I can use it. Well, think about that. And there are many other aspects to that version, but I won't get into that, take up the guest's time. I'm not going to do that. And the other thing, too, many Christians, and Jim, I believe this to be perhaps one of the most important aspects of what you're talking about the murder versus kill. You know, many Christians today, including the clergy response teams that I've heard, will say, well, wait, you've got to lay down your guns, turn in your guns, Romans 13, you know, the whole thing, we have to be passive, because that is, we are instructed by God. And I don't think there's anything in my Bible that tells me that I've got to sit back, and this is a pet peeve of mine, Jim, so I'm sorry, but you know, I have Christians saying, well, wait a minute, as a Christian, you know, you can't really defend yourself, and if your wife is being raped by ISIS or whatever, and your family's being ravaged and whatever, you just kind of have to, that's God's will, or you just have to deal with it. No, I don't believe that to be the case, but see, Jim, isn't it kind of like, you know, that is part of the deception,
yes,
in my view. So, okay. Sorry.
I totally agree. We could take up a whole program, I think, talking about that. But, as a Texan, when I'm told to love my enemies, then I take that to mean if they're really bad, I mean really, really bad. I'm not talking about somebody you don't like or somebody who says something that offends you. I'm talking about murderers, rapists, you know, the really bad of the bad. My idea, if you love them, then you kill them and you send them right on up to that big judgment in the sky. And it's not up to us to judge, but we can certainly put them in front of God a little quicker.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, I bumped you off track. Go ahead, sir.
Okay, well, back to the story. story. So Moses comes down, and he throws down the Ten Commandments, and he's mad because they have taken the gold, made it into a golden calf, because they don't understand the science and the technology that he had at hand. And in fact, in Exodus 32, it says, as he came near the camp and he saw the calf and the dancing, Moses' anger burned hot, and he threw the tablets out of his hand, broke them at the foot of the mountain, and he took the calf which they had made and burnt it with fire and ground it to a powder and made the people of Israel drink it. Okay, now think about this for a minute. If he melts down gold and makes the people drink it, he's going to kill them, right? Because you can't drink molten gold. But he ground it to a powder, and he made the children of Israel drink it. And that's because he knew the secrets handed down from the Anunnaki through Abraham and passed along through the Egyptian mystery schools. And Moses was thoroughly grounded and schooled in all of that. And we now think we even know where it came from. In 1904, the famous British archaeologist Sir William Petrie discovered on Mount Sinai in the southern Sinai Desert, which is also known as the Mount of Moses. He found what he said was an ancient Egyptian temple, and in there was a smelting process, a smelting operation. And when they lifted up the flagstones, they found a lot of white powder. But this was 1904. They didn't know what it was. They had no idea. And the desert winds came and just blew it all away, and nobody paid much more attention to it. But I think this was evidence of ancient technology that was being used. Now, before we invaded Iraq, now this brings us up to Iraq. Before we invaded Iraq, even the mainstream media was telling us that Saddam Hussein believed himself to be the reincarnated King Nebuchadnezzar. Well, okay, if that's the case, then I think we need to take a quick look at what was King Nebuchadnezzar up to. Well, we know that he built a structure out of gold. All right. Now, again, we have a problem with translations because it's come down to us in the Bible as a fiery furnace. But obviously it wasn't a fiery furnace because people would go in it, they come out of it, they get sick, they might die, but it wasn't burning people up. So he had a bit of this ancient technology, but he wasn't able to make it work properly. So what did he do? He went into Palestine and he found the three Hebrew priests, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and he brought them to Babylon. And he said, okay, you guys are high priest, and you probably have knowledge passed down through the Kabbalah and the Torah, and I want you to go in, I want you to see if you can't make that gold structure work. And they said, well, wait a minute, you're not our king, you don't believe in our God, we're not going to work for you. So he said, well, look, I'll tell you what, he said, I'm going to throw you in that thing, and you're either going to make it work or you're going to die. Now, interestingly enough, they didn't just grab them and throw them in. In the Bible, it says that they donned their hats, coats, and other garments. Well, what does that mean, and why should we care? To me, I'm thinking perhaps they put on some sort of anti-radiation suits or whatever. But anyway, they put them in the structure. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't even want to go near it, because he thinks it's dangerous. So he hollers out to his minions and he said, are those three priests in there? And they said, yes, O king. In fact, there's a fourth person in there. Now, oops, wait a minute. So he's created a gold structure, apparently created an energy field, and now instead of three people, there's four people in it. And he said, well, who's the fourth? And they said, a son of God. And that's the last we hear of that. We don't know who that was, where he came from, but it smacks of them creating some sort of energy field, which could then become like a portal or a stargate or whatever you call it, and you could move through it, because first there's three, then there's four. And that was the, that's the end of the story. And so we don't know who that was or how that was or what that was, but it smacks of ancient advanced technology. And we do know, what we do know is that King Nebuchadnezzar was so impressed that he put the three Hebrew priests in charge of Babylon. All right? So now we come up to present time, and we find that Nebuchadnezzar believes himself, the reincarnated Nebuchadnezzar, and he was trying to rebuild Babylon, and he was having French and German archaeology teams going all over Iraq, digging and coming up with more and more of the artifacts and of the tablets and of the information that had been laying under the sands there ever since the time of the Anunnaki. And then all of a sudden, we've got to invade Iraq on false pretenses. And in April of 2003, even though at that point the International Atomic Energy Commission said Saddam Hussein does not have weapons of mass destruction or a nuclear bomb, our own weapons inspector, Hans Blix, said, no, they don't have any weapons of mass destruction. But President George W. Bush said, I don't want to hear any of that. We're attacking. And we launched troops into Iraq in April of 2003. Now, Doug, what's interesting to me is, because I've been in, I'm an Army veteran, I know about military tactics and strategy. You set an objective, you capture your objective, you consolidate your holdings, your winnings, and once you're prepared, you move on to the next objective. We didn't do that. We made a beeline for Baghdad. And we left the rest of the countryside unpacified, and we left the weapons in the hands of the Iraqi army, which has still caused us trouble because some of those folks turned those weapons on us and became Al-Qaeda, which then morphed into the ISIL, or ISIS. Okay, so what's the big deal about Baghdad? They rushed into Baghdad, and the Baghdad National Museum was looted of thousands and thousands of objects.
Yes. Now, Jim, I'm sorry, buddy. I gotta stop you right there because we're at a hard break. But you know, this is what really caught my attention, and I had to rethink going back. And you really document this well in your book about the discoveries in Iraq, folks. This issue right here is kind of what pulled me into looking a little bit closer at the at what was going on exactly and precisely back in Iraq in 2003, what was found in 1999, or what was reported by ABC News back in 1999, that nearly 400 ancient Sumerian artifacts have been discovered. But we're going to hold that until we get back. It's just an amazing, when you look back, and again, past this prologue, and a lot of things that Jim is talking about here with respect to these artifacts and these findings, it's interesting when you look at it from just a different perspective than what we've been told, because we know that history has been revised, and anytime history is revised, there's a, well, history, his story, right? Folks, you're listening to the Hagman and Hagman Report. Doug Hagman running solo. Guest Jim Mars. His book, Our Occulted History. Of course, he's got Rule by Secrecy, the Rise of the Fourth Reich, and many others, including Crossfire. We'll be right back. Stay right where you're at.